On May 17, 1968, nine Catholic anti-war activists burst into a draft board in Catonsville, a suburb of Baltimore, in an event Martin Sheen would call arguably the most powerful anti-war act in American history. The Catonsville Nine burned hundreds of draft records in a fire fueled by homemade napalm. Who were the Catonsville Nine? How had they come together? What was their mission? And what happened to each of them? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
The bold actions of the Catonsville Nine made international news throughout the summer and fall of 1968, when William Kunstler defended the activists in federal court. The defendants, including priests Philip and Daniel Berrigan, gave stirring speeches against the Vietnam War and led the courtroom in reciting the Lord's Prayer. More than 40 years later, what kind of legacy does this act of civil disobedience have in American history? Joining us to discuss the Catonsville Nine is Sean Peters, a Catonsville native who is now a historian and instructor in the UW-Madison's Integrated Liberal Studies program. He is the author of several studies of the intersection between faith and the law, including When Prayer Fails, Judging Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Yoder Case. His most recent book, published by Oxford University Press in 2012, is called The Catonsville Nine, A Story of Faith and Resistance in the Vietnam Era.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
1968, I mean, you could hardly stop talking about all of the things going on in that year, but it was a year of considerable unrest and the sense politically anything could happen. Anything could happen in 1968. So by the time we get to May of 68 and this event with the Catonsville Nine, it's almost as if the stage is set, isn't it, for this kind of protest, this kind of public protest?
It certainly seems so. And as you mentioned, it's a year of great tumult. I mean, and many of the Nine had been really profoundly affected by the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
In April.
And it was interesting in writing the book to sort of keep track of, you know, there's a sort of micro history of the events in Catonsville and beyond, but also the macro history. And it was lots of things happened in the summer of 1968. There's, of course, the Democratic Convention in Chicago through the election later on.
It's up for grabs because LBJ has announced end of March that he's not running for re-election.
Exactly, yeah. And the Nine clearly were, you know, enmeshed in those events and inspired by them and really saw their witness as being, you know, interwoven with those issues, not just political issues, but economic issues, social justice issues, you know, you name it. It was all sort of in this incredible churning. And they saw themselves as being actors, not in a small, narrow drama, but as part of this broader drama that was being played out on the streets and, you know, all over the place in American life.
It wasn't just the draft that set them off then?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, the draft and the war in Vietnam itself were certainly the kind of the headline, and the fact that they, you know, attacked a draft office in Catonsville. But when you look even at the statement that they disseminated at their action, they were clearly interested in the American presence in Guatemala and sort of American imperialism, you know, writ broadly across the globe. That was one thing. And economic inequality, racial injustice, a lot of those things. And it got sort of lost in the retelling. I mean, when the story comes down to us now, we get it as a story about Vietnam. And I think understandably so, but it's important to understand the nuance, too, that they were interested in. It makes them fascinating as individuals to talk about when you look at their lives and you can sort of see the variety of things that they were interested in. It's really it's a compelling story because they were so compelling and they were so omnivorous in their interests.
And they seem so eloquent in describing how they felt answerable to a higher law. Not just the law of the land, but their faith. Can you say something about the Catholic faith that they all shared?
Sure. So this is a time, speaking of tumult, in American Catholic life, this is the you know, after the Second Vatican Council that really changed the way Catholics, you know, operated in the public sphere, especially American Catholics. And that was a moment, I don't want to overstate the importance of Vatican II, but there was a change between 1948 and 1968. And so you see American Catholics saying and doing things that they wouldn't have done previously. And many conservative Catholics actually saw that as a shock and as a something that was it sort of showed how the church was had lost its way, had sort of lost its bearings because of the Second Vatican Council. And that's a great – it's one another thing to sort of understand about this event is that it was very contested. Not all Catholics believed in the Nine. In fact, I would say probably most Catholics – might have agreed sort of with their ends, but certainly with not the means.
You also say in your book something about how the Catonsville Nine were as much sinners as saints, that you make a point of not glorifying them. However, it does seem when you see the photos, particularly of the Berrigan brothers with their collar, you know, as priests, to see priests being arrested certainly just visually has quite an impact.
It does. And it was shocking for people to pick up their papers. And this was national news, you know, to see the, you know, and the Berrigans had been out and had done illegal things before. So it wasn't a total shock to see them. But I think it was certainly unusual. And many Catholics at the time said, I can't believe that we have and in their clerical garb, breaking the law so overtly. I mean, they, you know, busted into this draft board. They made no pretense of trying to escape. And that it was a bold act, and it was an act of defiance. And lots of people had really never seen, certainly Catholic clergy, act in that kind of way. And it was very interesting.
If you look at the video of the event itself, it's almost hard to believe that it would cause such a stir, because you have this relatively small group of people standing in a circle and having a little trouble maybe getting the fire going like any other campers, you know, mm-hmm. but it just happens to be draft records, which don't even constitute this huge pile. It's not like a bonfire even.
Yeah.
And then they just kind of say something, well, there it goes. It's not a big dramatic event in the
One of the witnesses, an activist named Gren Whitman, commented afterward that he was struck by the quiet.
Right.
Then it wasn't a solemn occasion, but it wasn't a raucous event. I mean, we think
kind of matter of fact.
Well, not matter of fact, but it was subdued. It was a subdued moment for them. I think that they all said subsequently that they were really the moment itself really, you know, moved them. But we think about 60s protests. You think of people chanting and marching and, you know, singing songs, and that was not this at all. I mean, it was a very you know, they were very eloquent in what they said.
Said the Lord's Prayer.
They said the Lord's Prayer. You know, they did these things, but it was not a loud or, you know.
You don't hear sirens. You don't see police rushing up to them or anything.
No. And to be honest, you know, the Nine said at the time, here they are. They know that they're breaking federal law and seizing and destroying these draft files. And they sort of assumed that they were going to get arrested. But for a moment, they weren't sure. Nobody sort of knew what to do. And they thought, oh, that was part of the plan, was us being, you know, this act of civil disobedience. We expect the state to come and take us into custody and put us on trial. And for a moment, it was unclear as to whether that would happen or not, which, again, you know, in the moment, you know, it's easy to sort of pick that apart and to just see the kind of human element of it as well, rather than just saying, you know, they were these icons. They had it all planned out. It sort of wasn't like that.
Was there I wouldn't call it a tradition because it couldn't go back far enough for that in the Vietnam War, but were there precedents already for the public burning of draft cards, individuals burning their own cards?
Sure. There had been individuals burning draft cards, I mean, several years prior. And the Nine saw what they were doing. I think that they had understood the limitations of an individual burning his or her draft card. And they said, well, what would happen if we took several hundred draft cards at one or several draft records, you know, to really throw a monkey wrench into the draft, the process, the machinery of the draft, rather than doing it, you know, brick by brick with individual draft cards. You know, I think people understood that that was much more of a symbolic protest in Catonsville was mainly a symbolic protest, but it did have this practical dimension to it where they did demolish.
The one difference is that individual burning his own draft card, whereas these were people burning draft cards on the behalf of others.
Exactly.
And in an era before there would have been computer records, so it really was destroying some necessary files.
Yeah, it was one of the things I was really curious about, and I'm not sure if my sleuthing abilities, I was able to figure it out. But there is a kind of, when I've spoken about the book in the Baltimore area, people have come up to me and said, oh, I was one of the people whose draft record was destroyed. And I've had at least, many, many people have told me that personally, and that I want to believe that that's true. And people will say, oh, the Catonsville Nine saved me from going to Vietnam. I actually think that it's a good narrative, but it might not be completely true.
You mean there were backup files?
Well, there were backup files, and there were other ways of figuring out, who was registered where.
So it's a little more symbolic.
Yeah. I'm reminded of a professor in college who, said that, if everybody who said they had gone to Woodstock actually had been at Woodstock, there would have been 6 million people there, and that's, it's a little bit like that. And eventually the files were reconstructed and sort of business proceeded, and the war went on. I mean, the raid on the draft files didn't accomplish its sort of immediate goal of really seriously impeding the war, but the Nine believed that they could inspire others to engage in similar acts.
And they had, you mentioned that two of them, Tom Lewis and Phil Berrigan, had already put blood on draft records in a previous incident. Can you say a little bit about that? And I mean, why didn't they use blood the second time? Why did they go for
sure.
the napalm
yeah.
burning?
So the in the fall of 1967, a group called the Baltimore Four attacked draft records in the Custom House in downtown Baltimore, and they seized the records and poured essentially duck's blood over them. And for round two, so Catonsville was sort of the sequel to the Baltimore Four. And the Nine themselves said that the blood as a symbol had been sort of misunderstood at the time. They also frankly had a trouble producing the blood. They initially had thought that they would draw the blood, it would be their own blood, but they couldn't really figure out how to do that
as amateurs.
Easier than napalm. Was the napalm so easy?
No, napalm is very easy to make. Okay. It's gasoline and soap flakes. And that was part of the horror for the Nine. One of the reasons that the Army contracted with Dow Chemical to produce napalm and to have napalm as part of the arsenal was that it could be made by, they called it bathtub chemistry. You can make it pretty quickly. So I think if you ask Phil Berrigan, he would say, oh, yeah, the napalm was actually easier than the blood. But mainly it was a symbolic. They sort of thought that the symbolism of using blood was sort of misconstrued or misunderstood in some way. So fire, evoked the story of the Pentecost. And
it destroys the record.
And it's a better way of just, incinerating
more
as opposed
seen.
To defacing. And two, napalm was this weapon. I think it was an emblem for many people of just the absolute barbarity of the war in Vietnam. So that was a very intentional choice on their part. They really thought about how they were going to do it, as a practical matter and as a symbolic matter. Everything they did, they thought about how will people view it, what will it mean, how will it resonate, why will it resonate.
Were these necessarily secret plans, small circle of people involved?
They were relatively small. I mean, at one point they invited a bunch of people together in Washington, D.C., and activists who they sort of knew. They held a meeting and said, here's what we plan to do. And they certainly didn't, take out an ad in the National Catholic Reporter.
But they invited reporters, right?
They invited reporters to come along for the event itself. And, David Darst wound up being one of the Nine. And he was a guy in St. Louis who had some correspondence with Phil Berrigan. And he was somebody that none of them really knew. And they thought that actually he might be working for the FBI. And so word did get out beforehand, and certainly the FBI had lots of other things on its mind besides Catholic activists in 1968, but they recruited people, and it sort of, you know, through circumstance, you know, this was the group that sort of came together.
So was this procedure one totally without violence? Was it, I mean, in other words, they had access to the files. They had an insider who would show them where the files were. How did the actual event unfold?
That's a great point. You know, they, I think, conceived of initially as a nonviolent, the violence would be done to these records, and these records weren't property in the normal sense of property, in their view. And in the fracas that you can imagine, right, they show up at this office, it's a tiny little room, it's the middle of the afternoon, and they sort of rush in, and in their haste to seize these files, there was an altercation involving one of the clerks, a woman named Mary Murphy, who very stubbornly refused to let the Catonsville Nine grab as many draft files as they wanted to. And Mary Murphy was the word that gets used in the, she used it and other people used it, is that she was manhandled. She was sort of, Phil Berrigan sort of grabbed her and certainly didn't punch her, but she was scraped up and she needed to be bandaged later. And later, you know, she said, you know, Mary Murphy said that was one of the things that really bothered her, was that they purported to be these proponents of nonviolence. But from her perspective, and I happen to agree, that when someone shows up in your office unannounced, tries to steal your stuff and kind of knocks you out of the way, that's not nonviolent. And many other people felt similarly. Dorothy Day, the great Catholic pacifist, Thomas Merton, both had trouble with Catonsville because it wasn't nonviolence in the way that they understood nonviolence.
Certainly not passive nonviolence.
But no yes. one got severely injured, unlike the Sterling Hall bombing here in Madison or so many other.
Exactly, no. And her injuries were minor, and it wasn't, you know, she didn't have to go to the hospital or anything. And it was, but it sort of bordered on violence. And I think that certainly Dorothy Day felt that it was one step away from something that really could have been much worse. And I think the Nine, their response was, look, I mean, desperate times call for desperate measures. The nonviolence that they had practiced before, you know, they had participated in protests, they had written letters, they had done all the things that you're supposed to do, and then they didn't get anywhere. So they felt like they needed a new iteration of nonviolence. And that's another thing for me as an historian that makes the story, you know, interesting, to say it's much more complicated than just saying, oh, there were these sweet nonviolent people who mm-hmm. never hurt a fly. That's not true at all.
A little bit more ambiguous in that case. It's also, it's a group event, but you make it clear that they're interesting as individuals as well. And we're going to meet the Catonsville Nine and look at what happens when they go to trial when we return in a moment with University of the Air. I want to let people live, that is all. That's the comment of one of the Catonsville Nine, a group of activists that burned draft records in 1968 and then were put on trial. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Sean Peters, whose new book is The Catonsville Nine, A Story of Faith and Resistance in the Vietnam Era. So we have a group of nine people acting as a group, but they're also individuals, and in your book, you talk about the variety of backgrounds, and including, you know, a lot of them had nothing to do with Catonsville, that area. Can you give us some sense of the nine? You know, what is most important
sure.
to know about them, and what brought them together?
So, people, many people remember the Berrigans as these radical priests, and they sort of get top billing, and understandably so, but The other seven are really fascinating people. You know, you mentioned Tom Lewis, for instance, was a great artist in the city of Baltimore. Tom Melville and Marjorie Melville had been missionaries in Guatemala and had been involved in kind of proto-revolutionary political activities in Guatemala. John Hogan, another member of the Nine, also had been a missionary in Guatemala. Brother David Darst was a young man who was a teacher in St. Louis. There was Mary Moylan, who was a nurse. George Mishy, who was a laborer and social justice activist as well. And they kind of came together. It wasn't like they were lifelong friends who had known each other. I mean, the amount of time that they actually spent together as Nine people was relatively brief. And they were certain, obviously, you know, the Berrigans had known each other for a while, and Phil Berrigan and Tom Lewis had known each other for a while. But their relationships, there's kind of a web of connections. And that was one of the things that was really interesting for me in writing the book. I really wanted to make sure, especially the stories of David Darst and Mary Moylan. They're the two of the Nine whose stories kind of are forgotten. David Darst died in an automobile accident in the fall of 1969. So it was basically a year after their trial. And Mary Moylan had gone underground in the 1970s. And both of them were sort of, in the way the story is often remembered and told, they're sort of footnotes, or sort of peripheral characters. And for me, those are the kind of people that I like to write about. So I made a point of figuring out who they were and what they were about. And it really enriched my understanding. I thought I knew what the story was, and I really didn't. I didn't really understand who all nine of them were until I worked my way through.
Did it start with the Berrigans and then they brought people in?
Actually, no. I think most people think that that's the way it went down. Dan Berrigan was the ninth one. He was the last person to sort of sign on. Phil Berrigan and Tom Lewis. Phil Berrigan and Tom Lewis had done this earlier action of the Baltimore Four, and they recruited people for the sequel that became Catonsville. And in our memory, people think of it as Dan and Phil Berrigan, but it really wasn't at all. They really had to twist Dan Berrigan's arm to do it. He was really afraid of losing his position at he had a position at Cornell University. You know, he was a Jesuit. He was really worried about losing his status in those realms. And so, and he freely has admitted this, and that he needed to sort of he was lacking in courage, and his brother and Tom Lewis and some others, you know, finally convinced him.
What's important to know about the Berrigan family? I mean, this mother had to put up with both sons in and out of prison. And, you know, what in the Berrigan life story is most important to know that made them as activist a figure that they both became?
Their parents both. I mean, they came up in the middle part of the century, sort of at a time when publications like the Catholic Worker were gaining more prominence, and they learned about social justice activism at an early age. But, you know, Phil Berrigan, for instance, served in World War II before he went to seminary. He was a paratrooper in Europe, and he has, I think, in many ways, the most interesting intellectual and ideological journey. I mean, Dan Berrigan, it's much more linear, but Phil is, is somebody who was really involved in war and then came to regret that. And he sort of woke up over time in the 50s and the early 1960s, partly from reading the works of William Appleman Williams, the great UW-Madison historian. And he changed over time. It's one of the great broader stories of the book, is how his journey from someone very militaristic to somebody who spent most of, or I mean, a great portion of his later life in jail for nonviolent activism.
Well, it gives him a credential that the others wouldn't, in that, you know, you could say, oh, you're you're just a pacifist, or, you know, you're afraid of you know, war or something like that. But he's one who had actually been through it.
Yeah, and Tom Lewis had served in the National Guard, and George Mishy had been in the military as well. So there were three of the nine actually knew what it meant to get, you know, called up. And Phil Berrigan knew what combat really was. He had been there in World War II.
What about the husband-wife that you mentioned, Tom and Marjorie Melville, the former missionaries to Guatemala?
Yeah, they have a really interesting story. I mean, their story, I mean, it has been they wrote a wonderful book called Who's Heaven, Who's Earth, recounting their experiences in Guatemala. And for them as well, I mean, a journey where they sort of took at face value what they heard about American exceptionalism and our role promoting democracy and development. And what they saw on the ground in Guatemala was much different. I mean, you saw American corporate interests and essentially the CIA propping up this oligarchy in Guatemala. And so they, over time, came to realize that for that to be true Christians, to really live by the lessons of the Gospels, they needed to be involved in this essentially revolutionary political activity. And this is at a time when liberation theology is sort of percolating up from Central and South America.
Now, liberation theology, meaning that it would be part of your faith to help liberate the oppressed?
Yes, exactly. Liberation theology is a label that didn't even exist until 1968 and is sort of applied retroactively to a lot of stuff. But in their case, it's absolutely true. And they were a nun at the time. They were a nun and a priest, right, living these celibate lives. And they not only became revolutionaries, but they fell in love with one another. And at the end of 1967, I mean, can you imagine a more untenable position? You're revolutionaries and you're falling in love. They basically get kicked out of Guatemala and they come back to the United States early in 1968. And they get involved in Catonsville in order to publicize what was happening in Guatemala. They were very clear that they wanted it. They wanted the story of Guatemala to be as much a part of the public discourse as the story of Vietnam. And I think that both of them feel like it was completely overshadowed by the story of Vietnam. The Guatemala stuff really didn't come out
well,
at all.
Isn't it kind of counterproductive to split your focus for something like this? I mean, because the two events, although, yes, you could connect them, you could say they're both manifestations of American empire building or conspiracy or whatever. But I think in the public perception, and this seems to be the way it played out, the two things just didn't quite go together.
And that conversation happened while they were planning the raid. People said, geez, we can't get people to think about Vietnam. And now you want to bring Guatemala into the mix. But I do think that they clearly saw, they had such a global view of what was happening, you know, that Guatemala was just Vietnam all over again, essentially. And so they couldn't separate those things.
But how does that tie into the burning of draft records? Problem with Guatemala. How did they symbolically reconcile those two?
Yeah, I think that the idea was that they would be just sort of monkey wrenching the military establishment broadly. They had to pick something to attack, and this thing would allow, you know, this event, this act would allow them. And then what they really wanted to do was be arrested and put on trial, and then they could use their trial as a soapbox or a public platform where they could, and that actually worked spectacularly well. It was very effective. There had been a trial earlier in 1968 of these draft activists, the Boston Five. Dr. Spock was the most famous of the Boston Five. And the trial of the Boston Five was the opposite of the trial of the Catonsville Nine. There were no protest activities associated with it. And the Nine said, we're not going to do that. We're going to have a trial where the trial itself will be the whole thing will be just kind of a teach-in. We're gonna use our testimony at trial. We know that we're guilty. Everybody knows that we're narrowly legally guilty, but we want to tell the story about oppression, about militarism, about violence, and we're going to organize protests outside the courtroom. And they did that in a way that was really moving and unique, not only for the nine themselves, but, you know, thousands of people came to Baltimore and participated.
And what's most important to know about John Hogan, the other missionary?
So John had been with them in Guatemala and had never – didn't get quite as immersed in those activities as Tom and Marjorie Melville did. But he, too, came to realize he had the sort of same philosophical orientation, the same political orientation. And John is somebody who was far quieter and didn't – quite garner as much attention, but in his own kind of quiet way, you know, was there. I mean, one of the things I really liked about, or in terms of their own descriptions of the protest, you know, John's description of it, and he sort of said, man, my heart was beating. I couldn't believe I was doing this. And that's really, he was a very human figure. You know, he's somebody who didn't, and subsequently didn't really get involved in very much political activism. He lived in New Haven, Connecticut, and but continued to help people and was somebody with a real open heart.
I noticed the simplicity of his statement, like the one that I opened with, I want to let people live, that is all. Just a very simple statement that he made.
Right. And in contrast to the sort of soaring and even poetic, you know, Dan Berrigan, not is somebody who is a poet. You know, he had written books of poetry and won awards for his poetry. And, of course, his statements were these, you know, elaborate and wonderfully, you know, evocative statements. And then you have John Hogan just basically speaking from his heart in a much different way. And I think it proved to be a really wonderful compliment, too. And you really did – it was one of the interesting things about the nine, too, is that they rhetorically were very different. You know, Phil Berrigan was very strident and – Dan Berrigan was very poetic, and John Hogan, and you get different ways of articulating things. It's not, they're not just sort of robots repeating the same stuff.
Are they writing these statements down before the actual event? Is there a written document, a mission statement, if you want to call it that?
Sure. They handed out a statement at the time, at the demonstration itself. And it's funny, Dan Berrigan, because he was so late in joining the group, really didn't play much of a part in drafting the formal statement, but he drafted a separate meditation later that has become much more famous. People sort of assume that this meditation that Dan Berrigan wrote subsequently was the statement of the Cadenceville Nine, and it really wasn't. And at trial, they clearly had prepared some stuff, but they also mainly just spoke from their hearts then, and in a way that was really emotional and moving. There was a lot of crying that went on in the gallery at the trial of the Cadenceville Nine, because it wasn't, and I'm somebody, you know, I've written a lot about law, and trials often are, they're just a grind. It's not, what we see on TV is not really, it's kind of boring. And this was not that way. There are moments of that, but then there are these discussions that they have about, you know, the role of the United States in global, you know, policy and things that you just don't normally get. The judge at the trial really allowed wide latitude.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why didn't he silence them more? Was he sympathetic?
I don't think he was sympathetic. I think that he was worried about being accused of shutting them off. He knew that they were going to be found guilty. So I think he said, well, why? I'll just let them have their peace and then I'll instruct the jury. Essentially what happened was they testified about, you know, anything and everything. And then when it came to, you know, charge the jury, he essentially said to the jury, you know, all of that stuff that you heard about the Dominican Republic, about Guatemala, forget that you can only the matter of their legal guilt is all that we are here to decide. So did they here are the elements of the crime, and on May 17th, 1968, did these nine people, you know, do those things? And for the jury, that was
easy because that was never denied.
What were they charged with, and how did they plead?
Well, they were charged with mainly destruction of federal property and interference with the Selective Service Act. And they pled not guilty, and that's why that there was a trial.
Not guilty by reason of
conscience.
Not the fact that they didn't do it, obviously.
Right. They said, well, you know, here's our explanation. This is why we did it. And they analogized their actions to what someone might have done in Nazi Germany. You know, the actions of the Nazi regime were narrowly legal, right, in the sense that the Third Reich had enacted these, you know, reprehensible statutes that enabled things like the Holocaust. And what the nine said was, look, we think something similar is going on now. We think that the Selective Service Act, it's an immoral and unjust law, and therefore we're following our conscience by not complying with it.
What kind of job did William Kunstler do as defense attorney? How important was that figure in this story?
He was a catalyst, and Kunstler was this great attorney. I mean, if you name a legal struggle at this time, you know, Kunstler was involved, and Kunstler knew that I think Kunstler, like any attorney, really thought that maybe he could win. Maybe he could figure out a way to score a legal victory. And he tried, you know, he seized on the instructions to the jury as something, as an issue on appeal. But he sort of got it. He knew that the nine wanted to use their trial to tell this story about imperialism and about the war and about Guatemala, all of this sort of constellation of peace and social justice issues. And he was really effective. It's hard for me to think of them having another attorney who could have done that kind of – and he's a wonderful performer as well. I mean, a very dynamic individual. And so you had – it's another thing that makes the trial so great is that you had Kunstler there, you know, performing and doing these things. And then you had these nine eloquent and diverse individuals, you know, using the trial to tell their stories.
Did Kunstler at this point already have the reputation as being an attorney who would take on these political activist cases?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the most hated lawyer. The subtitle of his biography is the most hated lawyer. He was already the most hated lawyer in America.
What kind of cases had he taken on?
Well, the Chicago 7, he was sort of in that.
That was the Bobby Steele and that.
Right, and he had been involved in civil rights cases. And I mean, he said that Keynesville kind of transformed him. He had already sort of been doing this kinds of things, and Keynesville really launched him even further into that kind of career.
And you include, I forget the wording exactly, but some kind of statement he made that made it sound as if he had gotten emotionally attached to these nine himself, that he felt for them as more than just a lawyer.
Absolutely. He was very – and especially Dan Berrigan, I think, was the member of the nine who sort of touched him most. And, you know, as an attorney, you're not supposed to do that, right? You're supposed to just, you know, do what you need to do to do your job. And that he felt himself drawn into the cause in a way that he hadn't been as much before. And so if you – the story of Kunstler's career. I mean, Keynesville is a really important moment for him. I don't think he would be the same William Kunstler that we know today if he hadn't been involved in Keynesville too.
We're going to look at the verdict, the sentences, and the aftermath of the Keynesville Nine when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Sean Peters, who is telling us about the Catonsville Nine, a group of individuals who in 1968 broke into the draft board office, the Selective Service Office at Catonsville, Maryland, and then used homemade napalm to destroy draft records in order to make a political statement about one thing and another. And what would some of those things be when we look back at it, Sean? I mean, 1968, you do have the war in Vietnam. You have people protesting that in particular. You have people protesting war in general. You have people protesting the draft. And then in the case of a couple of these nine, protesting U.S. activities, covert and otherwise, I guess, in Guatemala. So what does this protest really become as it goes through the court system?
Well, I think in a way they wanted to offer an indictment of their own about American society and sort of how, you know, the promise of American society remained unfulfilled, whether it was because of economic inequality or whether it was because of, you know, the way our foreign policy had operated. But they saw this sort of disease infecting the American body politic, and the most sort of acute symptom of it was Vietnam. But there were these other, you know, manifestations of it as well. And the turmoil, certainly in 1968, you know, the turmoil in the nation's inner cities as well. And that, I think, as time has gone on, certainly the way it has come down to us through history is that broader message has gotten sort of diluted. I mean, we think of the nine sometimes. It's 1968, it's the war, and that's the shorthand. And maybe that's inevitable. But at the time, I think that they did a reasonably good job of in some ways it's an impossible critique to really articulate when you say here is a broad, you know, right, socioeconomic, political system, and these are all the things that are wrong with it. Like that's sort of impossibly complicated in a lot of ways. I think that they did it, though, in a way. There aren't a lot of trials in American history where those things were articulated as well as they were at the trial of the Catonsville Nine.
And they seem to keep making statements about how the president should be brought to trial, or make it kind of question who's the criminal and who should really be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so their trial takes place about a month before the presidential election of 1968. And there's a lot going on. You know, Spiro Agnew is the Republican vice presidential nominee. He's the governor of Maryland at the time. They want to highlight, you know, all of Agnew's many they didn't even know about the really bad Agnew transgressions.
All of those little political corruption.
The kickback.
Yeah. Which would lead to his resignation.
He was at the time was getting the bagfuls of cash, but in the state capital.
Didn't know about it.
Took about five years.
They said, you know, we want to put the war on trial and Johnson should be the one on trial. All we did was go and burn some paper and try to save some lives. You know, what kind of crime is that compared to, you know, masterminding this war that has led to not only tens of thousands of American lives being lost, but hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of lives being lost among people in Southeast Asia.
Well, tell us the sentences and how the different members of this Catonsville Nine responded, what choices they made.
Sure. So they were found guilty, and it didn't surprise most people. Dan Berrigan later said, I would have been really, you know, if we'd been found not guilty, I would have been really surprised. I would have asked what had gone wrong in the process. And their sentences varied. They weren't, you know, these weren't incredibly onerous, you know, 10 to 15 year sentences. They ranged from about a year and a half to 3.5 years. Phil Berrigan and Tom Lewis got longer sentences because they had engaged in this earlier protest at the Custom House in Baltimore, and they didn't immediately go to jail. You know, there were a rather lengthy appeals process that lasted for about a year and a half. And when it came time for them to report for their prison sentences in the spring of 1970, four of the nine, the Berrigans, George Mishy, and Mary Moylan, decided that they weren't going to report for their prison sentences, that they were going to go underground. And at the time, many people disagreed with that decision. You know, it again seemed to be a deviation from what most people understood to be sort of traditional civil disobedience. The idea was that you accepted your punishment. And they, you know, decided that they, desperate times called for desperate measures, and that they were going to use their status as fugitives to further witness for social justice and peace. And that chapter is a really interesting chapter in this story, you know, where Phil Berrigan and George Mishy were, you know, sort of captured relatively quickly. You can imagine J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI. I found some great documents where he's, you know, in the margins, he's just scrawling these angry. But Dan Berrigan remained at large the entire summer of 1970 and really mocked the FBI. And he would appear periodically and basically said, nah, you can't catch me. And really, it was an interesting moment. You know, there was this fugitive, you know, think about this fugitive priest sort of on the run from the law. It was really kind of an amazing story. And eventually he was captured. And one of the things I spent a whole chapter on this because it was so interesting, you know, Mary Moylan, she evaded capture until 1979, mm-hmm. in which she was underground for almost the entire decade of the 1970s. And they didn't catch her. She turned herself in. And it was a heroic story of resistance, but it, you know, it sort of morphed into something darker for her personally, because being a fugitive is really hard emotionally. She was cut off from friends and family and really impacted her life in a negative way as time passed.
Was she the one that was also a bit bitter about not being given her due as a woman?
Absolutely, yeah. Her commitment really changed. I mean, even before she went underground, she became much more interested in issues of women's rights as well. And she came to view Catonsville as this very patriarchal situation where you had these male priests sort of getting the glory, and then you had, you know, women herself and Marjorie Melville sort of relegated to the periphery as well. And she said while she was underground, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't have done it with men. I would have done it with my sisters. And that was, you know, her, and she drifted away from the church, and she drifted away from the peace movement, and she changed, you know, over time as well. And it's a really poignant story, and it's a sad story as well, too, to see sort of, you know, the Berrigans became these icons. There was a, you know, a Ben and Jerry's ad with Dan Berrigan. They were on the cover of Newsweek. They're famous people. Mm-hmm. And that was not Mary Moylan's experience at all. She had a much different experience.
Does this become at all a critique of the Catholic Church then?
For her, certainly. It did. You know, it's interesting for the nine. Phil Berrigan left the priesthood a few years later, and you know, their individual connections to the church became somewhat more tenuous. Certainly not Dan Berrigan, who's still alive and is still a Jesuit, you know, fighting the good fight in New York City. But for the rest of them, yeah, they became less. I think that they drifted from the institutional Catholic Church and saw themselves more, you know, living the lessons of the Gospels as they saw, they sort of made that their own way.
Can you say something about the cultural impact of this event? I mean, you mentioned the Ben and Jerry's ad, but you also talk about, you know, plays, films, board games, et cetera. Can you say something about what this Catonsville 9 event came to mean?
Sure. I don't think that as many people would know about the Catonsville 9 today if there hadn't been a play. The play called The Trial of the Catonsville Nine, that Dan Berrigan essentially redacted or boiled down the trial transcript and turned it in. Eventually it became a play and was performed on Broadway and has been performed all over the world every year since then. And it became, and the play was made into a film. Gregory Peck made the film. And so the cultural memory of it has been shaped and perpetuated by these cultural forms, these tellings of the story. And one of the things that was interesting to me in writing the book was that I wanted to go beyond the trial. That the play is really a powerful event to see, but it's only a snapshot. It's only a frame in a much longer and broader story. And so, and when we do, and they show up, you know, people remember who the nine were. You know, Dar Williams had a song about the nine. And so in Trivial Pursuit, there were a couple of questions about the nine. So they come up, and as a historian, I wanted the story to be more complete than these little sort of cultural pieces that were kind of floating around.
And you're a Catonsville native.
I am, yeah. So I'm not old enough to really, really remember the event when it happened. I was about a year and a half old, but it was a town where I grew up.
Was there a historical marker?
You know, it's interesting. I have this discussion a lot when I go back home. It happened on the grounds of the Knights of Columbus. The draft board was in the Knights of Columbus Hall. And the Knights of Columbus are this Catholic fraternal organization who really are, I guess, ambivalent is probably the nicest way of putting it. They don't necessarily want people to celebrate something that was in many ways an attack on American institutions and a critique of the church itself. And I've been asked a lot, you know, should there be a marker? Could there be a marker? And I don't think on the grounds of the Knights of Columbus in Catonsville that will ever happen. But it's right on the main drag in Catonsville across the street from the public library. And I've seen guidebooks actually that mention that there's like a guide to progressive landmarks in the United States. And it says, you know, Frederick Row, Catonsville, Knights of Columbus Hall. So people know about it, but there will not, I think in the foreseeable future, you will not see a historical plaque denoting the site.
But maybe your book is in the library across the street.
It is in the library across the street. And so I did research there in the library as well too. And the reception in Catonsville, I've been back a few times since the book has come out. I've had kind of an interesting reception talking to people who were alive at the time, new people who were involved in the story as well. And that's been really rewarding for me too.
Were there subsequent demonstrations or events that were patterned specifically on Catonsville?
Certainly broadly, in Milwaukee, there was a protest involved. They were called the Milwaukee 14, who attacked the central draft office in the city of Milwaukee in the fall of 1968. And they actually demolished far more draft records than the Catonsville Nine did. And there were numerous attacks on draft offices inspired by Catonsville. And Lewis Hershey, who was the director of Selective Service, really was somewhat freaked out by what was happening. You know, there were these sort of guerrilla attacks on draft boards, and they weren't able to stop the draft that way, but they were able, certainly in their view, to impede the draft and to draw attention to the inequities in the draft process.
Our guest has been Sean Peters, telling us about the Catonsville Nine, an incident in American history from back in the spring of 1968. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour of University of the Year.
God of the poor man, this is how the day began. A co-defendant sigh, Daniel Bear again. Oh, and only a layman's patch of napalm. We pulled the draft files out, we burned them in the parking lot. Better the files than the bodies of children. They had no right before the love of you. They had no right before the love of you. Suffering Tom in Guatemala, Philip in New Orleans. Oh, it's a long road from law to justice. I went to Vietnam, I went for peace. They dropped their bombs right where my gun.